Good morning. It's good to be here. It's especially good to be here in fairly decent health. I'm not sure what it is about preaching that makes me sick, but the first time I was supposed to preach, I ended up in the hospital on an IV. This week was better. I only ended up in bed with the flu, and that has subsisted into a head cold, which is comparatively delightful. So this week is the first of two sermons that we'll be having on Sabbath. Last week, we had two sermons on rest and Sabbath. Rest is the corollary of, did I say that right? Last month, we had two sermons on work. Did I say that? I can't even remember. Okay, last month, we had two sermons on work, and this month, we're going to be having two sermons on work's corollary, which is rest. Before we begin, let's pray. Holy God, thank you that you are present in our midst. Thank you that you have given us the gift of rest. Pray that you would inhabit the words that I'm about to speak, that they would be your words, and that if any of them are not your words, that they would fall on deaf ears. Pray that you would bless this time that we have to think about Sabbath, and that you would create within us a desire to enter into the rest that you have prepared for us. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. At the end of September, my husband and I went up to Taproot Theater in Greenwood, and we saw Enchanted April, which is still playing. For any of you who haven't seen it, it's delightful. I would highly recommend that you get a chance to go. The play begins in London in the winter of 1922. It's cold and rainy, damp and dreary. Sounds sort of like another city I know in winter. Lottie is an unappreciated housewife, tired and weary of being good. When she spies an advertisement for a month at a villa in Italy, her heart leaps at the thought of wisteria and sunshine. The beauty of that vision prompts her and a new acquaintance, Rose, to rent the villa. Now, the promise of beauty lures these women out of their lives of duty and dreariness and loneliness and ennui. And the reality of that beauty, once they reach San Salvatore, lures them out of their hard shells, works on them and works in them to soften them and open them like seed pods. They begin to live more joyfully, to love more freely, until by the end of the play, they're living and loving with abandon, without counting the cost. Enchanted April speaks of the power of beauty to transform our hearts and to break us free from the shackles that constrain us, shackles that we put on ourselves and shackles that other people put on us. But it also underscores the reality that we have to place ourselves in the way of this beauty. We have to choose it, and sometimes that choosing is costly. Rose and Lottie both have huge and painful arguments with their husbands about their decisions to go to Italy, and they leave damaged, if not broken, relationships behind them when they get on the train. They've had to break with what is known, and therefore comfortable, however unpleasant at times, in order to turn toward what is beautiful. And at first, their decision seems a horrible mistake. When they get to Italy, it's dark and raining. Talk about adding insult to injury. But in the end, they get their comfortable known relationships back, transformed like themselves by the beauty of San Salvatore. Since I've been thinking a lot about Sabbath in preparation for this sermon, I immediately thought this play was an apt image of Sabbath keeping. Of course, right? It takes a lot of effort to get there. And like Rose and Lottie's initial night of discomfort and rain, it sometimes seems as if we've expended a lot of effort on a disappointing end. But if we persist, as Rose and Lottie did, we experience great beauty and joy and transformation. Like San Salvatore, with its wisteria and sunshine, which was just waiting for Rose and Lottie to come and enjoy it, Sabbath is a gift that God has already given to us, a gift of time, of freedom, of delight, of rest from our labors. We have only to open our hands, our hearts, our lives, and receive it. This gift of Sabbath is a reminder that we are free people. As Dan read from Deuteronomy, the command to keep the Sabbath was a weekly reminder to the people that they had once been slaves in Egypt and that God had set them free. There's a different version of this command in the book of Exodus, which recalls the pattern of creation. God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh day. As Dan and Jeff pointed out last month in their sermons on work, God is the divine worker, but God is also the divine rester. Created in his image, we are called, we are commanded to follow suit. Like God, we work, and like God, we rest. Uh, at least we're supposed to. But too often, we're like the Israelites when they were slaves in Egypt, working all the time with no rest. Oh, it's good work we're doing. We're providing for our families and caring for our kids and volunteering at church or with Young Life or at the Union Gospel Mission and coaching soccer and Little League and leading Girl Scout troops and counseling friends, and the list goes on and on, doesn't it? It's all good stuff, important stuff even, but too much of anything, even a good thing, will make us sick. And that's why God issued that other Sabbath command, the one that Dan read, the one that reminds us that we are no longer slaves in Egypt. We are free people. For freedom, Paul says in Galatians, for freedom Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery. Part of the freedom that Christ offers us is this gift of Sabbath, a day every week to rest and remember that we are free people, to cease working, to play, to be present with those around us and with our generous, gracious God, to notice the good gifts in our lives, the good gift of life itself, and to love with abandon. But often we are like the Israelites, grumbling that slavery is better than freedom. Freedom is risky and scary and uncertain. Just as the Israelites worried that their freedom from Egypt would mean there was not enough food to eat, we worry that our freedom from the demands of our work means there might not be enough time for all that we have to do. We are busy people, after all, and our time is valuable. Yes, our time is valuable. Our time is so valuable that God insists we save some of it, setting it apart for Him and for others. He wants us to give Him and ourselves a day every week. A day every week. Can you imagine? A whole day to stop running on the crazy treadmill of too much work and not enough sleep? A day to stop being available to everyone so that we can listen to the whispers of our own hearts, our longings, and our losses that we too often ignore or cover up because we're busy checking email or Twitter or running off to a meeting or throwing another load of laundry in the washer. A day to look at the people we love and really see them, to see their brokenness and their beauty, and to let it melt our hearts with love. A day to take a slow walk around our neighborhood and notice the color of the leaves on the trees and listen to the birds and feel the sun on our backs and the wind in our faces. A day to turn off the computer, to shut our ears to the cacophony of internet and social media so that we can hear the whisper of God as He says, I love you. Stop. Look at me. I want to be with you. I love you. If you are weary and worn out by the demands of your life, if the thought of such a day makes your heart leap with longing, you're not alone. You're just human like the rest of us. And you need a day off from all of it every week. Hear the invitation of Jesus to you. Come to me, all you that are weary and carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. A yoke is what oxen wear. It's what allows their driver to steer them. Now, we all wear yokes of one kind or another, and someone or something holds our yoke and steers us in the direction it wants us to go. Jesus knows that, and He offers us His yoke, the easy yoke, the light burden of freedom. For freedom He has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery. The slavery of our time is urgency. Everything must be done now or a minute ago. We're always running to catch up, and we're always doing too little, too late. Now, I'm a writer, but as a writer, I'm also expected to market my writing. And marketing gurus are minions of the tyrant urgency. They tell me I have to make a book trailer. I have to post YouTube videos. I have to blog and join Twitter and Facebook and update my status multiple times a day. I have to read other blogs and comment on them. I have to host book parties and join professional organizations and speak at professional organizations and speak at other venues and otherwise get my name and my message out there, or the world's going to pass me by and my books won't sell and I'll be a has-been before I ever get to be an is. Whatever line of work you're in, I expect it's similar. The demands on your time are increasing. The amount of work you're expected to do is increasing. The constant need for professional development and networking is encroaching on the time you have to do your real work. And if you don't keep up with all these new developments, the world's going to pass you by and you're going to be a has-been too. If you're at home with children, like I am, you're expected to be a soccer mom and a ballet mom and a gymnastics mom and a piano mom. If there's an enriching activity out there that your child could be doing, you're expected to sign her up and be her chauffeur and her cheerleader and her coach. Because if you don't, the world is going to pass her by, and you don't want that on your head. When you add to all these ever-increasing demands, our various volunteer activities and our relational commitments, we don't have time to stop and rest, to take the day each week we so desperately need. We've chosen our yoke, haven't we? Or we've let the people around us choose it for us. We are yoked to the tyrant urgency, and we are running as fast as he will drive us, only he never relents, and we can't keep up this pace. We need a different yoke, and that yoke has been offered to us. It's the yoke of Jesus, the easy yoke, the light burden. Come to me, he says. Come to me, all you who are weary and carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. But even if we choose Jesus' yoke, it is still a yoke, it's still a burden, and we still have to walk under it. And I'll confess, the yoke of freedom feels heavy sometimes. It is hard to stand free in a world that is enslaved. But just as Rose and Lottie wanted their month of wisteria and sunshine badly enough to risk the disapproval, disappointment, and anger of their husbands, so we too can cling to this Sabbath command and live under it. We just have to want the beauty of rest badly enough. If you're like me and you're weary of being harried and anxious and rushed, if you're tired of being tired, if you're horrified by how much of your life you're missing because you're always trying to be one step ahead of where you are, stop. Seriously, just stop. You have the power to stop. You are a free person. You can stand firm and refuse to submit to the slave-making yoke of urgency. You can take a Sabbath. But it will take some effort, won't it? Some thought and planning. Otherwise, you'll find your undone tasks will slowly encroach upon your day of rest. So here then are a few practical ideas of how to open your life to the gift of Sabbath freedom that God offers to each of us. First, start slowly. If Sabbath is a new practice for you, or if you want to deepen or extend an existing Sabbath practice, choose just one or two things that you want to change. And if you're so busy, you're thinking there's no way you could take a whole day from all the work you have to do, you don't have to start with a whole day. Start with half a day, with dinner Saturday night perhaps, and a restful evening of reading or playing games or taking a walk or whatever it is that's restful for you. Go to bed early, get up, have breakfast, come to church. You've just had half a Sabbath. Gradually, you can add in brunch or lunch after church, an afternoon nap, some time reading the Bible, praying. Again, whatever feels restful to you. Until you've worked up, or maybe I should say rested up, to a full Sabbath. It might take several months to get there. That's okay. It's not about perfection. It's about making the attempt to give this one day into God's hand and letting him hold our lives and our work while we rest. My husband and I began keeping a Sabbath 4 years ago. We decided that it would be a computer-free day. And that was the only change that we made. Since he's a techie and I'm a writer, turning off the computer seemed a logical way to ensure that we wouldn't be working. Now that social media have invaded our lives and our cell phones give us access to the internet wherever we go, we've had to put limits around how we use our phones and how we use social networking. For me, Sabbath is an internet-free day. I don't check email or Facebook or blogs. I don't web surf. I don't write. This gives me freedom to do other things, to be present to my life and the people in it, to really listen to them and see them and to delight in them. And that brings me to my second idea. The Sabbath is ultimately about relationship, relationship with God and relationship with others. We rest from our work so that we can enrich our relationships. So as you consider what practices to embrace and what to eliminate, keep relationships in mind. Perhaps a shared meal with family or friends, or if a meal feels like too much work to you, you could take a walk with those people. At our house, we try to take a walk together, maybe play some frisbee in the park. We also eat together. Sometimes it's burgers from Red Mill, but we're enjoying them as a family. Every Sunday evening, I call my parents who live in California so that they can talk to their grandchildren and I can hear about their lives. Relationships are central to Sabbath. Third, prepare for Sabbath before Sabbath. If you wake up on Sunday morning or whatever day you decide is going to be your Sabbath and you think, I'm going to have a Sabbath today, your ability to enjoy the freedom of Sabbath rest is going to be sadly eroded. You still have to eat. If you have kids, they have to eat too. If you've not made plans for your Sabbath meals, you might find yourself frustrated that you're working instead of resting. If you've not done laundry and have nothing to wear, that's going to create issues too. If you've got a deadline and you've not made sure that you're caught up before Sabbath, that could interrupt your day of rest. So think, what do you need to do beforehand so that you can enjoy a day of rest? I'm going to close by outlining our family Sabbath practice. I hesitated to include this because I don't want anyone to think it's prescriptive. It's not. It's simply one example among many, and I include it partly because our practice is so far from where I want it to be, and at the same time, it's so much closer to what I want it to be than it was a year ago. Sabbath is a process, one that changes as our lives change, and one that we grow into as much as it grows within us. So here then is what our family tries to do on the Sabbath. Of course, no two are exactly alike, and some weeks fall far short of the picture I'm about to paint. Two months ago, we shifted our Sabbath to begin with dinner on Saturday evening. Until then, we'd practice Sabbath on Sunday from waking until sleeping. And largely this shift backwards was because I was tired of waking up on Monday morning with a kitchen full of dishes and an inbox full of email. It made me dread Monday morning, and Sunday evenings were kind of stressful too as I sat reading while the dishes whispered menacing words about how awful the morning was going to be. So now Sabbath begins with a simple meal on Saturday evening. Doug and I turn off our computers, and our family gathers around the table. We light a pink candle. Pink is my daughter's favorite color, and she really wanted a pink candle. It's also the liturgical color for joy, so that reminds us that Sabbath is a delight, a gift, something we get to do, not something we have to do. We enjoy eating leisurely. I do the dishes after dinner, but again, in a leisurely manner. I try to be present and feel the warm water as I rinse off the plates and glasses. And to say a prayer of gratitude that I live in a place where water is plentiful and comes into my home in this amazing and mysterious way that is so easy and convenient. We have the kids pick out their clothes for Sunday morning. We try not to rush, even if that means that bedtime is delayed a bit. On Sunday, we have a nice breakfast, which my husband faithfully prepares. And then we come to church. I'm learning that I can't sleep in on Sunday mornings, otherwise I'm rushed and harried, and that's the exact opposite of what I want my Sabbath to be. After church, and I'm usually one of the last people out of here because I don't have anywhere else to go or to be, I can stay and chat and catch up with people I otherwise don't see. After church, we have lunch and maybe a nap. Well, Doug and I try and have a nap. The kids play more or less quietly in their bedroom. If the weather's nice, we go for a walk. If not, we play games at home or we read aloud to the kids. Sometimes we'll watch a movie. At dinner, we light the pink candle again and say a Sabbath blessing. Though this marks the official end of our Sabbath, I still try to inhabit a quiet place as I do the dishes and get the kids ready for bed. We call my parents, and the kids both talk to them. Then Doug puts them to bed while I chat with my folks. After the phone call, I'll sometimes check email to make sure I'm not going to be overwhelmed on Monday morning. Other times, I'll sit and read a book, extending my Sabbath by a few hours. Throughout Sabbath, I am intentional about being present where I am. I live so much of my life in my head, thinking about other places, other people, other things, and not actually being where I am. On Sabbath, I try to be where I am. I put my book down if the kids want my attention. I put my book down if Doug wants my attention. I look at them. I listen to them. I try not to formulate my response until they're through speaking. I notice the world around me. Right now, the leaves are the most amazing colors, and I don't want to miss that. I give thanks to God for his creativity and his love of beauty. I eat slowly, savoring my food instead of bolting it down. I let myself stare out the window or sit on the porch and stare at the street or the sky. I try to be aware of the gift that is my life and turn my gratitude Godward. Now, inevitably, things come up. Doug's parents call at the last minute and say they're driving down, so I have two more people to feed than I was anticipating, or I didn't plan well enough, and we don't have food for lunch, and I have to stop at the grocery store, or Doug has a meeting, or he has to work, or I'm preaching. Our Sabbath practice is not perfect, but we still try. We don't quit just because we don't have perfect Sabbaths every week. We learn, or try to, from the things that aren't working and adjust our practice so it can be more of what we want it to be, a day of rest and rejoicing, of reveling in the love of God and the love of life and the love of those who love us. At the end of Enchanted April, Rose and Lottie returned to England, but they returned transformed by the rest and beauty they experienced at San Salvatore. They returned with hearts full of delight and love. Our Sabbath rest transforms us too and makes us able to return to our working lives renewed, refreshed, and free to live and to love with abandon. And that is what I hope for all of us, that we would embrace this gift of freedom that Christ has already won for us and come to know the beauty, the delight, and the joy of Sabbath. Amen.